Welcome to Worlds Apart. For decades, the United States was the only great power able to strike anywhere in the world with impunity while also enjoying an unprecedented security advantage, being bordered by two mellow neighbors and shielded by two vast oceans. This unique position allowed America to reap many benefits, but is it now leading it down the hill by making it both ignorant and arrogant? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Philip Giraldi, Executive Director of the Council for the National Interest and a former intelligence officer for the CIA. Mr. Giraldi, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for being available.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Now, you've been a very vocal critic of the American war machine, not only on ethical, but also practical grounds, because it's draining the country's resources and obscuring its real, authentic social needs. And you often ask the question of what is the U.S. national interest in pursuing all those wars? And I want to start by asking, what's your own answer to this seemingly rhetorical question?
Well, I think the national interest of the United States is actually pretty clear. And it's probably like most other countries in terms of when it has good leaders, it tries to make the lives of the people who are citizens better, improve their finances, enable them to have more freedom. And when it's a bad leader, we have just the opposite. They look for wars as an excuse for not having to answer any of those questions about what the interest should be.
You know, there was a time when an American dream was very appealing to the rest of the world. It had a lot of soft power, at least when I was younger. But right now, I don't think it has any appeal or any Americans actually believe in that. And if we look at the hard data, economic data, social data, it's clear that, you know, the resources are not where the priorities are. And I want to ask you, why do you think the American people have been going along with that for too long? Because I think even the Russians would not put up with, you know, their real concerns being put on the back burner for so long.
Well, I think it's a simple answer, actually, that the American people are basically lied to regularly, both by the government and by the media. Now, the media is the important part of this equation, because when the media is doing its job, it should be trying to find out what the government is doing that's wrong. But we haven't had that in quite a while. And to answer the other part of your question, I'd say very few people aspire to be an American anymore or to come to the United States. This has been a dramatic turnaround in the last 30 or 40 years.
Now, there have been a series of conflicts, big and small, that drained American resources and also killed many people around the world and led to the unprecedented number of refugees and internally displaced people. We actually have a humanities record at this point. And just recently, President Biden was trying, at least there were some reports that he was interested in ascribing himself more war powers than he would afford to presidents when he served as a senator. How do you understand that? Is there any other, you know, dream war that hasn't been fought until now?
China, apparently. the thing is that that statement by Biden was probably one of the most dangerous statements I've seen to come out of the lips of an American head of state. He basically said that it was up to him, using his judgment of what kind of threat was out there, to start a war whenever he wanted. And this is a contrary to the U.S. Constitution, for one thing, and it's even contrary to the War Powers Act that was passed after Vietnam. So this is a real scary statement, and he really wasn't taken to task by it, by the media or anyone else.
Now, I think what makes it even scarier, and I don't intend to be disrespectful of his age, but it's, I think, pretty evident to anyone who sees President Biden making impromptu remarks that his cognitive capacity is somewhat compromised. I mean, like, it's hard to argue that. How do you understand the decision-making process in Washington at this point? Who are those people who are making those vital decisions, not just on the issues of war and peace, but actually on the issues of the existence of humanity? Because if they, you know, launch a war or a limited operation against China, that could go bad very quickly.
Yeah, it could, and it would. I think there's no question. China is nuclear armed, as is the United States and a number of other countries. And the fact that once you start taking the genie out of the bottle, and the genie being nuclear weapons, it moves to a catastrophe level for the human race very quickly. And that's why this kind of stuff is very dangerous talk. It should not be allowed. And when people come out with these lines, they should be contested immediately.
Now, what bothers me is that unlike, let's say, Iraq, Iran, or Syria, where the United States can do things with impunity, pretty much, Russia and China are different sort of adversaries. I mean, as you mentioned, they're nuclear armed, and some experts believe that Russia, for one, has superior nuclear capacity capabilities to the United States at the moment. Do you think people in Washington, whoever those decision makers are, actually understand that there is a different caliber of adversaries that they choose to pick up a battle with at this point?
It's so obvious to people like you and myself who follow the news and follow the stories and follow what is going on in various parts of the world, that that's precisely the case. This is no longer knocking. There was a neocon back a while ago who said every once in a while, like every 10 years, the United States has to attack a small country to maintain its credibility. Well, that was crazy then. But now it's not crazy when you're talking about nuclear arms.
Now, I mentioned Syria, and I remember when the Russian military operation in Syria began, I happened to be at the U.S. Embassy reception, seeing the American ambassador at the time, John Theft, fuming with anger and disbelief at the news that the Russians would send their fighter jets to Syria at the invitation of the Assad government. And I wonder if that was in a way a prelude to the current Ukrainian conflict, the Russians allowing themselves to do what they thought was right at the moment and going so explicitly against the American preferences?
Well, my own personal preferences are for countries not to invade other countries under any pretext, unless there is a palpable threat coming from that other country. Now, so the United States has done this numerous times, and it only seems to be annoyed by this kind of practice when the Russians are doing it.
I'm not sure we can equate the Russians and the Americans here, because you mentioned the palpable threat, and I think the Russian leadership has been pretty explicit that their main goal of intervening in Syria was not to sort of spy the Americans and contest the global leadership, but actually the counterterrorism threat. And you being a counterterrorism expert for so many years, don't you think that was a legitimate argument that, you know, in any country, almost any country that the United States gets itself involved to make a better place, we have a problem of terrorism, drug trafficking, weapons trafficking, etc.?
Well, see, the problem is you could use the arguments two ways. And the United States is in Syria with precisely the same argument that Russia was using to enter into the country in support of the government. Now, the United States claims that it's there to destroy ISIS. But of course, now it's been how many years and they haven't destroyed ISIS yet. I think it's legitimate that Russia, as an ally of the Syrian government, which is a legitimate government, should be able to assist an ally. The United States, on the other hand, uses the same argument, the terrorism argument, to justify what it is doing. And I think in both cases, you have to look very carefully at how legitimate the argument really is.
I know that counterintelligence cooperation between Moscow and Washington continued for some time, even after the bilateral relationship took a turn for the worst. As far as you know, is it still ongoing? And do you think it's possible to revive it in any shape or form in an authentic way that will benefit the security of both countries and both peoples?
Well, I think the professionals who work for the intelligence agencies and also in the military on both sides are quite willing to establish some kind of secure dialogue where the issues that could explode and turn into a world war can be dealt with in a diplomatic way. I think they're quite willing to do that. The problem is the politicians who are at the top of the systems, and particularly in the United States, where we have politicians that really are ignorant of the major issues that they're confronting in a kind of casual way. Like Joe Biden right now really wants to get reelected in 24, and he wants to look like a strong wartime president. That's not a good thing.
Now, Mr. Giraldi, you describe them as ignorant. Are they truly ignorant or arrogant? Because, I mean, with all due respect, our countries have a history of rivalry and animosity, and we actually know each other as, you know, adversaries. We are both nuclear armed countries, and, you know, those are serious things. But I think one difference is that during the Cold War, there was some parity, the sort of treatment of each other as equals. Do you think the United States treats Russia, China, or any other country as a legitimate threat at this point of time?
Well, I think they would probably understand that if it goes too far and we have a nuclear war, yeah, they could get hurt. But I think up to that point, they are arrogant in their thinking that it won't happen because they are carefully managing the situation and they have a great deal of power that they have at their fingers. And so I think it's a difficult question, but I think there are, during the Cold War, there were a lot of sensible people who actually made sure that it never went to that point. I'm not so sure we have those people in power right now.
I've heard one very respected Russian analyst who, by the way, was an honorary doctor at several American universities when the relationship was functional. He said that one thing that changed is that the Americans totally lost fear and the protective capacity that comes with fear. Because if you are fearful, you think twice about, you know, cost-benefit, about the means and the goals. Do you think that's true, that the American administration, at least, has lost any fear of what may come out as a result of its actions?
Interestingly enough, I think the answer to that is kind of divided. I think the military people are conscious of what is on the table. I think it's the others who are pushing for these wars tend to be like the Tony Blinken State Department, Victoria Nuland State Department. These are the real warmongers. These are people who never served in the military and have no idea of just what they're talking about. So it's a bit of a divided house, I think.
I see. Well, Mr. Giraldi, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
Русофобия оказалась выгодным бизнесом.
Они Украину предали, ограбили и отдали на растерзание американцам. Украину, мою родину.
Эти люди готовились достаточно открыто, финансирование проводилось достаточно широко, и мы знаем всех акторов, кто это финансирование получал.
8 лет двигались ровно в этом направлении, чтобы вот расчеловечить русских и разорвать все связи.
Это результат серьезной работы над историческим сознанием.
Преступление против человечества задокументированных на украинских территориях очень, очень много. И большая часть из них совершена при попустительстве или по прямому приказу нынешнего или прошлого киевского руководства.
Уже они давно вышли из легального поля, давно, значит, действуют другими методами, неконституционными.
Это и есть преступление по нацистскому образцу.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Philip Giraldi, Executive Director of the Council for the National Interest and a former intelligence officer with the CIA. Now, Mr. Giraldi, before the break, we talked about how manipulative the official American discourse on the war could be, including the conflict in Ukraine. And I think what I'm seeing and hearing right now from the American media is just the... I think it's all based on the assumption that Russians are evil, full stop, and one doesn't need to understand either the Russians thinking about why this war happened or even understand the Russian history, which is deeply insecure when it comes to war, because unlike you, we have fought many wars with many neighbors, and for us, providing for our security is a very... a sensitive subject. Do you think the American people actually understand what is at stake for the Russians in this war?
Well, they don't understand it. And the reason they don't understand it is that it's because the media has basically been totally on the side of Biden and the administration when they say that, well, if Russia takes Ukraine, then they're going to take the Baltic states, then they're going to take Poland, all of which is ridiculous. And this is what the American public is hearing. Vladimir Putin, I think, has spelled out very clearly why Russia intervened. And a lot of it makes perfect sense. But this is not what the American public is hearing, unfortunately.
Now, you mentioned this very bizarre idea that if Russia prevails in Ukraine, and, you know, it's a separate question of what that means, because I think, for one, Russia doesn't have the resources to support a country with a hostile population. So I'm not quite sure that Russia is really eager to take over Ukraine. But this whole argument that if Russia wins somewhere, that it's going to expand, it's based on the idea that Russia actually has the resources to do all of that, whereas in fact, I think the Russian leadership has been very much focused on making sure that domestically people do not suffer, that social programs are functioning, that lives is improving, that people are able to do business, that the level of business and personal and political freedom is expanded. And, you know, it got me thinking about whether... the Americans are so insensitive to Russia, to China, and many other countries because they have or they are failing at their own American dream. Because with or without the conflict in Ukraine, both the Russians and the Chinese are pursuing their national destinies in a very focused way, you know, being mindful of what to spend on war and what to spend on development. It seems that the Americans, from what we have been discussing, have lost that capacity to, you know, to have the focus on both.
Yeah, I think you're correct in saying that. What comes across to me is very much the culture of a country, and a country will either go with a culture which defines it and kind of dictates what kind of actions it will take, or it gets away from that. And I think the United States has gotten away from being a culture, from being a country in that sense. We are technically, I'm sure you know, bankrupt because of all the spending on these wars and on military costs, which we will never get back. And people know this, but they don't know why it's so. And it's because we've lost our sense of purpose, our sense of culture. And that's what I believe.
Can I ask you specifically about Ukraine? Because I remember a few years ago during the Obama administration, the U.S. policy in Ukraine was about creating another quasi-Russia that the Russians could look at, get jealous of, and sort of get rid of their own government. At least that's how the Obama administration officials articulated it. How do you understand the U.S. policy vis-a-vis Ukraine at this point? What is Ukraine for Washington right now?
If you go by what they are saying out of the White House and Pentagon, you would hear them saying that this is done to weaken Russia, to prevent Russia from becoming a challenge. And it sends a signal to China not to follow the same path. And there's a great deal of concern for in Washington for countries that are competitors. And I don't think there's anything wrong with competition. I think a competition between Russia and China, all for different styles of government, for different styles of country, is a good thing. And but this is the kind of paranoid thinking that prevails in Washington, and it's really unfortunate.
But Mr. Giraldi, there is also a huge difference between competition and confrontation, because competition, you know, it encourages development and innovation, but confrontation costs a lot of money. When you say that the United States is after weakening Russia, do you think these people have actually calculated in, like, in material terms what it's going to take and what it's going to cost the American taxpayer? Because Russia, after all, is the largest country in geographic terms. And again, as we mentioned, it has a pretty strong military. It has formidable nuclear weapons. And, you know, its population is also not about to yield to, you know, decision makers in Washington.
Oh, I agree. And I don't think Russia should yield to them. And I would add to your list of attributes of Russia, tremendous natural resources. It's definitely whatever the United States would want to do to diminish it or confront it, it's going to be a major power, whether you like it or not. And the same goes for China. The trick is to not confront other countries that are competitors, and to work with them. And this used to be the job of diplomacy, but the United States has forgotten that.
Mm-hmm. Now, going back to Ukraine, the Ukrainians, and I myself half Ukrainian and have relatives there, so I'm not adversary to them, but I think when you look at their political system, they like to talk about independence, but when it comes to self-sufficiency, they're historic record is not very strong. In fact, most problems between Russia and Ukraine politically erupted after Russia tried to move to market prices for its oil and gas. And Ukrainians didn't like it because for years they had been receiving, rich Russia's resources at subsidized level. And as you have written, at this point of time, the U.S. Treasury is the main source of Ukraine's national budget. But its resources, the U.S. Treasury's resources, are also not unlimited. How long do you think the United States will be able to bankroll Ukraine in such a way?
If I had to make a prediction, I would predict that the United States will try to keep this war going until our election next year. Because, again, Biden and his group around him are trying to play the card that the United States is being strong. It's sending a signal, and it's looking out for the security of the American people and the country in general. And of course, that's all nonsense. This is all politics. And I'm afraid that's the closest to a realistic assessment of what this is about and how long it will go on.
I think both Russia and China have gone through their periods of, let's say, national humiliation. In China, there was a century of humiliation. In Russia, we also had a pretty humbling period after the collapse of the Soviet Union and, you know, trying to pull ourselves as a society, as a culture, as a state from a very difficult position. And I think to some extent, to a significant extent, we have succeeded. What do you think the American humbling would look like? And I'm not having any ill wishes here. I'm just curious about how do you think the American society can transform itself to sort of get rid of these vested interests that have misplaced national priorities for so long?
I rather suspect that the direction that all of this is going in will bring about something like an economic collapse, sort of like what happened to Russia after the Soviet Union, Mr. Yeltsin was in charge, and the country was looted by Europeans and Americans. It won't be exactly in that form, but the economy is going in a very bad direction. The debt level is beyond any kind of recovery. And sooner or later, this is all going to come home. And when it does, there will be time for I hope, peaceful revolution in the United States to change the way we think and the way our politics work.
It reminds me of the phrase that American officials like to repeat, that what happens in Ukraine will have a direct impact on the strength of the U.S. democracy. And I wonder if they actually have a true sense of sort of foreboding or premonition, not so much about the state of U.S. democracy, because I think it's quite contested, but about the U.S. governing system, that what will happen in Ukraine will ultimately decide the future of the American system as it exists today.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that I find interesting is the fact that probably the one thing that Ukraine leads the world in is political corruption. And if there's a country behind it that one might look at, it's the way the United States political system has been corrupted by special interests, by people with agendas. All you need is a little money.
I think one other thing that is in common between the Ukrainians, the political Ukrainians and the political Americans, is this belief that perception is reality. This old mantra, I think, that was coined by one of the Republican advisors of Ronald Reagan, if I'm not mistaken. And for a while it worked, but do you think reality will sooner or later catch up with people in Washington? I'm sure it's already catching up with ordinary folks around the United States, but do you think they can realize the danger that for themselves, let alone for the country, before it's too late?
Well, let's put it this way. They should recognize the danger. How it will happen or when it will happen kind of depends on other factors. And at this time, either the war in Ukraine is going to be a success for the Biden White House and that they will come out looking good from it, or it's going to be a catastrophe. And there will be a lot of people thinking about, we have to do something about this.
But even if they come up looking good, I mean, he can have a second term, but the question I think still remains whether he will do anything for his country, for his people, to address many of the issues that we have discussed today. One last question I want to ask you about. When it's finally over, whatever it is, and whatever in whatever form it may be, do you think the Russians and Americans can be not friends, but normal people again? Do you think I will ever be able to travel back in the United States and you will be? Well, I think you're actually able to come to Russia. Russia has not limited visa issuing to the Americans. But do you think Russia and America could ever again cooperate on a mutual and respectful basis?
Well, I can only draw on my own experience. I've been to Russia twice. I've been to St. Petersburg, and I've been to Moscow when RT had its 10th anniversary. I was a speaker. And I was a former intelligence officer. They let me in. There was no problem. I knew many KGB officers when I worked overseas in Europe and the Middle East, and we got along just fine. I would say, there are people out there who want to fix this, and there are people out there who want to make sure that there is a good future for both Russia and the United States and for China. And we have to find them. We have to put them in positions of authority where they will make things change.
Well, on this hopeful note, we have to leave it. Thank you very much, Mr. Giraldi, for sharing your expertise with us today.
Well, thank you for having me on.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.